something that we really invest in is sampling. For our brand, you can really experience the benefits. So it's so worthwhile for us to invest in sampling and then leave it to influencers or customers or individuals to share their experience.
Carly Stein Kramer is the founder and CEO of Beekeepers Naturals, a company that uses bee propolis to help you reinvent your medicine cabinet. She discovered the healing powers of propolis when she fell ill when studying abroad in Italy. And after returning home, she discovered there wasn't anything on the market similar to what she had used. Today, Beekeepers Naturals is one of the leading holistic wellness products in North America and is instrumental in saving the bee population. Coming up, hear how Carly's unique hobby helped her form her business. Carly explains the behind the scenes of what propolis really is. You'll learn all about Carly's process to scale a product-based business, and finally, her secrets to building a great team. This is the Entrepreneurista podcast, presented by Socialfly.
It's the best business meeting you'll ever have, with must-hear real-life looks at how leading women in business are getting it done
and what it takes to build and grow a successful company.
It's beyond the gram.
With no filters,
no limits,
and plenty of surprises. So many of us have ideas for businesses, but we often don't start them because we either don't know where to start or we feel like we have to have everything figured out before we start. And after mentoring so many women over the years, I have always shared the advice to just get started. So we've created a new segment on our show in partnership with Square for you to hear the actionable steps that founders have taken when they were ready to turn their idea into a business. So you can see that it is possible for you to just get started too. Carly, we are so excited to be here with you today and hear all about your Entrepreneurista journey and story starting your business. Can you tell us, do you remember that moment when you knew you just had to get started and actually turn your idea into an actual business?
I do. I had a lot of little moments leading up, a lot of like, ooh, this could be a good idea, or, you know, there's a hole in the market, that sort of thing. But I had a specific moment. I was working at Goldman at the time. And I had a great job. I was very fortunate to have this job, but I do not care at all about finance. And I was, you know, I had pulled an all-nighter. I was just like, I remember I was eating one of those. Have you guys ever had the frozen Oreos you get at like 7-Eleven? It's like ice cream.
I've never had them, but I've looked, those look delicious.
I was eating that at 5 a.m. I had pulled an all-nighter at work. And I was just like, this isn't what I'm meant to be doing. And I had all these ideas leading up, and I just, you know, it was kind of it for me. I was like, I need to prioritize my dream here and my vision. And like, if I don't do it now, I'm not going to do it. And it's time to make that move. It was like that tipping point where my like entrepreneurial drive sort of overran my fear and my anxiety.
Yes, I can definitely relate. I was actually working across the street from you at another financial services firm and also did not want a career in finance and wanted to pursue something more entrepreneurial. And I remember the day that I quit my job. Stephanie and I actually quit on the same day. Walk us through that process of quitting your job. Did you already start the company and it was a side hustle, or you quit and then got started?
Yeah, so I had a funny journey. So I started beekeeping when I was in college, and I really kind of started the company without starting the company. I'd started beekeeping and I was making these products, and I was just really trying to solve my own health issues. And before I knew it, I had really engineered a line of products and I was sharing them with roommates. The next thing you know, people on Facebook were messaging me to buy products out of my dorm room. And I was like, huh, this is interesting that broke college students want this. There's a market beyond myself. So I was having little moments where I was selling products, but ultimately I graduated with a lot of debt and I was really fortunate to have a good job offer. And I took that, and I just found myself kind of, you know, working really hard. And I think it was really exciting initially because it was new and challenging, but working really hard to go down this path that just wasn't for me. And this was always in the back of my mind because I had done it in college, because I had helped myself, because I really fell in love with beekeeping. And that's, you know, one of the great passions of my life. I really had this dream of disrupting healthcare, reinventing the medicine cabinet and saving the bees while I do it, which sounds a little weird when you say it like that, and probably why it took me so long to make the leap. I would share this idea and people would be like, stay in finance, kid. Like, it's a little weird. I had this dream for a while, and I had kind of sold products on the side and dipped in and out of it. But it was really I left my job end of 2016, and that was when I went full throttle into this.
What were some of the first things you did when you were finally able to focus on your business full time?
When I started the company, it was literally just me getting out there. Like, it was me standing at farmers markets all day, selling products, any convention, any pop-up shop. Anytime I could be somewhere selling products, getting products into people's hands, I was doing that. I remember every Sunday I would go around with a backpack, with like a backpack full of propolis, and go into the smaller mom and pop health food shops and try to get people to sell my product. I was even getting people to sell it on commission, just really trying to get the product out there. And it was just like pure hustle. And I had a product, and I have a product that I really believe in. And I knew that I just needed to get it into people's hands and really let them have their own experience with it.
What was the first product that you created?
Right here, my propolis.
My propolis throat spray.
Yeah, how I kind of got into all of this. So I have an autoimmune condition. I was always sick and I can't take antibiotics. So I really didn't fit into the traditional healthcare model. And from a really early age, I started exploring the world of natural. And it was kind of a frustrating experience for me because I was dealing with something chronic and something viral, and a lot of the sort of wellness supplements just, I wasn't having an effect, and they were expensive, and I was spending time and money to use these products. And I really felt like it was very polarizing, traditional healthcare and wellness, and there had to be something in the middle. And when I was in college, I did a semester abroad, got really, really sick while I was abroad. I was really fortunate to meet this incredible pharmacist who told me all about propolis. And it was the first time I used something and had a full recovery. And it just really changed my immune system. I stopped getting sick all the time. Everything really changed. And then I started beekeeping, fell madly in love. And so it was an interesting path. I was really solving my own problem before I even thought about starting a company. And, you know, I thought I was going to go into research and that was going to be my life. And so my biggest challenge, which was my health, led me to my greatest passion.
When you were initially selling at the farmers markets, the product that you were selling, this product that I have right here, which I absolutely love, use it all the time, were you making it in your kitchen, or how did you get this product made in the early days?
First of all, you have to have a beehive to harvest propolis. So my original beekeeping mentor out in British Columbia, where I went to college, I was sourcing propolis from him. He had taught me a whole sustainable harvesting style. And so he was like the only person I felt comfortable working with. So I was literally shipping that to New York from Canada. And then I had lab equipment. I purchased lab equipment and I would do the extraction myself, do it all in my kitchen. I was doing this all in a studio apartment, and then bring it with me to the farmer's market and put up my cardboard sign and share it.
Just want everyone to know I'm sitting here Googling propolis while you're talking about it, because I know absolutely nothing about bees or beekeeping or the health benefits. So I've been so excited to talk with you, Carly, because as someone who also has an autoimmune condition, I have MS, and my whole life I was also sick and have never been, I feel like I'm into a lot of these natural products and I've never tried your products, and I'm just salivating right now. I'm like, oh my gosh, you both have this. I need to try this. Am I not going to get sick now? So I need to know everything about what propolis is. Tell me.
Amazing. Okay, well, Steph, we're definitely going to get you some propolis after this, but just a really quick propolis 101. Everyone knows honey. That's something we all know that comes from the hive. And a lot of people think like, oh, propolis must be a honey derivative. The bees actually make a lot of different things. Propolis is not a honey derivative. It's a substance the bees use to line the hive and keep it germ-free. You can kind of think of it as the immune system of the hive, what it actually comes from. You know, if you cut a tree open, sap will trickle out. It's the immunoproperties of the plant itself. So the bees will collect that. They'll collect plant and tree resins, mix it with their enzymes. They make this sticky amber-colored substance called propolis, and they line the entire hive with it. It's the primary line of defense. And then for humans, Propolis is antiviral, antifungal, antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory. It acts as an immunomodulatory agent. So that's why it's really great for people who are struggling with autoimmune. But it's a really great way to support your immune system. There's benefits for gut health. People love it for inflammation, antioxidants. And the cool thing is it's very much a part of the medical system in other countries. In Poland, they'll use it in the burned wart for its antibacterial and anti-inflammatory properties. There's parts of the world where they do intravenous propolis. You know, it's really integrated in other cultures, but in North America, it's very, very new. And so that's kind of what Beekeepers Naturals is built on, really bringing this trusted, time-tested tool that can be used to help people's health and really bringing it to the mainstream in a format that makes sense.
So interesting. And thank you for sharing that. And you have a new customer.
I love business models where you're helping people and also, you know, giving back to the community. In your instance, you're helping the bees. I'd love to learn more about, now that you've scaled this business, you know, obviously your production is outside of your kitchen. How does this work at scale? And how are you helping the bee community?
Yeah, this is my favorite question because this is something that I was really intentional about in the early days. And it was a huge headache in the early days. And it made a lot of investors very nervous because just the time it takes to scale. But it set us up in a way that I'm really proud of. So we're a benefit corp. Our mission is to save the bees. And so we have built a sustainable supply chain. So what we're doing, let me take a step back. We are the only bee product company that practices pesticide-free beekeeping. So every single product we make, it's third-party pesticide tested. Like our raw product, we test for pesticides, toxins, and pollutants, all pesticides, toxins, and pollutants in accordance with Health Canada. Only when it comes back clean do we go on to the next phase and actually make products with it. And we do that to make sure the bees are not exposed to pesticides. And yes, it gives us a really incredible end product. But what it allows us to do is control for pesticide exposure. And pesticides, some people who are very pro-pesticides like to dispute this point, but pesticides are the number one thing hurting the bees. Bees pollinate one-third of our food supply. They've been, you know, their population has been in decline over the past few years. Neonicotinoid pesticides, which is the most common type of pesticide used in the U.S., is a big problem for the bees, affecting their spatial reasoning, contributing to bee decline. So how it works with Beekeepers Naturals, we're only working in pesticide-free remote apiaries, and we're only working with regenerative beekeepers. So when I started, by the way, this was not a thing. Like the regenerative beekeeping was not a thing. Even harvesting propolis, I had to go in there and teach people how to harvest this. There really was not a market for it. And so now as we grow, because we have this pesticide-free commitment, we can only work with people who are keeping the bees in essentially a bee habitat, a clean habitat for them. So as the company scales, our supply chain scales, and we've really championed this regenerative beekeeping industry. So it's a really cool thing where as we grow, do-gooder beekeepers get to expand and we get to build the market for pesticide-free and humane beekeeping practices.
When you're first starting a product-based business, the setup of your business, how you operate your business is very different from what you've now built today over the past several years. Can you talk about some of the business tools and solutions that you were using when you first started your business? And then at what point did you hit scale and have to change processes and tools in your business? And what are you using now?
Yeah, it's so funny thinking about what I used in the beginning, and I hope everyone listening who wants to start a business knows that you can, like, you know, if you're passionate and hardworking and diligent, it will happen. Because I did not use any great tools in the beginning. I had a bunch of spreadsheets going and I was doing a lot of cold calling. And I think something for me that was really challenging, moving from literally doing this in my kitchen to a proper drug facility and contract manufacturers, was I had to hit a certain scale to be able to do a production run. And it was hard to hit that scale when I was a one-woman show, going to the farmer's market, doing the selling, creating the products, that sort of thing. So I had a little bit of a chicken-egg situation. So in the early days, the biggest things that helped me, I spent a lot of time listening to podcasts and really focusing on negotiating tactics. And my big first challenge was get a co-manufacturer to do a production run for me, with less than, significantly less than the normal amount you would put down, and taking a huge bet on me. And so it was really putting together a lot of tools that were compelling about the potential growth of this business, and learning how to negotiate and speak the language, and learning about co-manufacturers and just how these contracts work, which was something that was very new for me. So I literally Googled everything, figured it out on the fly. I didn't have any remarkable tools. We use a lot of great tools now as we scale, but in the early days, it was just trying to figure things out that were very, very new for me.
How did you figure things out? Did you have mentors or other people that you would lean on or ask questions to?
I didn't have a lot of mentors at the time. For me, when I started this business, it was really tricky for me. Everybody thought it was a very bad idea. I was on a very good path and I was doing something. I always say this idea was so different. There wasn't a precedent for it, right? I wasn't saying like, oh, I'm going to start a makeup company. I'm going to start, you know, the next protein bar. When you say like a medicine company based on propolis, people are like, okay, what is propolis? So I didn't have a lot of support that I could turn to, which meant I had to lean on resources like podcasts and books. And I found, you know, so much support in that. There was so much information accessible. And I think I had to kind of keep building myself up because I didn't really have anyone that totally understood what I was doing. And I think that skill set of just cultivating resilience and leaning on yourself, that is what carries me today. It carries me through fundraisers and it, you know, carries me through any challenges I have. But that was sort of an early psychology-based skill that I had to really cultivate to develop this business. I think that was the big thing.
How did you convince that co-manufacturer to work with you? You talked about sharing the vision, sharing the growth, but do you have any tips to share on how to convince someone to take a chance on you?
Well, that one, it was ultimately a bad deal for me, which I was totally comfortable with because I guaranteed him a very high percentage of sales of the product. And I was really confident in the sales. And then it was just, you know, about selling the story and selling what I could do and that sort of thing. And I think creating that type of structure, which allows you to just get the job done. And it's not, you know, it wasn't a forever thing. It wasn't a guaranteed percentage of sales forever. It was for a particular product run that this person was supporting. That allowed me to get out there. And I think it's just getting into the head of the person you're working with and creating a deal structure that makes sense for them and moving as quickly as possible to bring your product to market and bring your idea to life.
Up next, learn from the biggest mistake that Carly has made. Can you share any mistakes you made in the early days when you first launched?
I mean, I made every mistake.
Tell us all of them and what you learned.
I think out of stocks was a really challenging thing. So a very, very big thing for me was getting into retail. I was selling in farmers markets. I put up an online store and we had pretty great sales there. But I needed to have a few flagship retail locations because I really needed to get stronger distribution and I needed to show purchase orders to do that. And so I got us into Whole Foods Canada and I did that just being like full level 10 creep, messaging every person on LinkedIn who worked at Whole Foods, like sending fruit baskets with notes about what's bee pollinated, like just like cheesy, cheesy stuff, full out just stalking people. But I ended up connecting with a gentleman named Bobby Turner, who at that time managed Whole Foods Canada. And he was moved by the story about the bees and cares very much about the cause and decided to give me a chance. So that was like my first real deal, big account. I got us in there and we had a situation with one of our suppliers and I could not make my second product run on time. And it was so frustrating because it was like, oh my gosh, it's going, like it was in some ways a champagne problem because there was demand for it, the product sold, but I had asked these people to take a huge chance on me and then I was an awful partner because I couldn't fulfill demand. So that was like a really challenging thing to work through. We made it through, you know, it was an important lesson early on for me to understand how important it is to figure out your needs when it comes to inventory on hand, and especially, you know, a product company, you're a working capital intensive company. And so there's a lot of modeling that needs to take place. And I was not doing that modeling at that time, doing like less than half of what I should be doing. And, you know, I had I was using a couple spreadsheets and thinking I had it down. So that was my first kind of big mistake and really important learning. And I was very lucky that people were sensitive to me, because, you know, that could have been way worse. I could have pissed off Whole Foods and never gotten in that account again.
What did you do in those moments when you had those challenging times and, you know, you would now, I don't call it stalking, I say research. You had researched your way to get to Whole Foods, and now you have this incredible opportunity and moment, and it seems like things are not going to work out. Like, how did you keep yourself going? What did you do in those moments to communicate with Whole Foods to smooth things over? Any advice you can share about dealing with those challenging situations? Because they come up for entrepreneurs all the time.
Yeah. So I really believe the individual with the calmest nervous system always wins. And so I had to get myself very, very calm, and I did not feel calm, and I have a ton of anxiety and I would freak out. But the second I got on the phone with a customer, a partner, a potential connection, I was very calm, very, very calm, very accountable. And these are all things that I really value on my team today. We talk a lot about accountability on my team, very accountable, very transparent. I think people really appreciate that. And, you know, I never, no matter how many mistakes I made, I never tried to cover it up or blame or push people off. I was just always like, hey, this is what happened. I was super direct. Let's deal with this head on. And, you know, this is on me, and whatever consequences there are, I will receive them.
That's so interesting, because, you know, running a business obviously has a lot of ups and downs, and sometimes it can be very easy to get emotional about things. But Stephanie and I always try to stay calm in crazy situations, and I've never heard anyone articulate it that way. How did you learn that staying calm is kind of the best way out of sticky situations?
Trial and error. I was not always calm. It's so funny, because I wouldn't consider myself a calm person. I'm a very emotional person, but I have learned and I understand the importance of staying calm in these situations. And I think, you know, I'm sure you guys have shared this experience as a leader. There's just so much that comes to you when a team's leaning on you, and they look to you and they look to your body language and just how you're reacting to certain things. So that's always a good kind of level setting thing. It pushes me to be very attuned to myself. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think I cultivated a lot of this when I was in finance. I worked with individuals that had explosive personalities. I got yelled at a lot, and I received that, and it didn't feel good. And, you know, for me, it was really demotivating to be addressed in some of those ways I was addressed. And I, especially as I was starting the business, when I was making mistakes, having been on the other end of emotional responses, I knew that that is not a way to cultivate respect or repair this relationship. And I was just very attuned to it because I had received so much of it.
That's so true. Nothing good happens when we're having heightened emotions and they're screaming and yelling. Like, there's just not a good outcome for anyone, anyway, anyhow. So I love that you share just your learnings and how your experiences brought you to realize that, and how it's just shaped how you've led your company.
I think that if I hadn't been at Goldman and been yelled at so much, I don't know that I would have come to that conclusion in such a timely fashion. I think I probably would have had a few more challenges. But, you know, I had a few years in finance as an analyst, and it was at a time where the expectation was to work around the clock, and I didn't personally receive great treatment. So I was very aware of it.
Coming up, you'll hear all of Carly's secrets for building a great team.
How have you built your team now that you've scaled? You have a team. What's your leadership style, and what are the roles on your team now that have helped you get to where you are?
Oh, we have so many important roles that help me every single day. I mean, my sales team is incredible. I have an unbelievable marketing team. My operations team help everything function. My finance team is amazing. My data team. Every single team is of equal importance, and they all work together in a way that's really beautiful. And I think how I run the team today and how we've been able to scale the business and identify these amazing individuals that make up the team is really staying mission-driven, really focusing on the problems we're trying to solve. We talk about all the time internally, we were talking about the three P's, people, planet, propolis. And really, I think it's about empowering people to make a change in the world. And maybe I'm sounding like a little corny here, but I really believe in that. I talk a lot to my team about entrepreneurship, having entrepreneurial individuals within the organization and having people really own what they're doing. It's very much a meritocracy to have an entrepreneurial organization. It has to be a meritocracy because people have to be celebrated when they create incredible things. And we've really created a culture of collaboration, something that's just big on my team. We talk about a lot. It's one of our guiding principles. The obstacle is the way. I think that perspective is really important for any entrepreneur, for any business, for really anyone doing anything, because problems are always going to arise. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to look at that problem and say, what can I learn from this? And what new way can I move through this?
When you're in the hiring process and looking for the right talent to be on your team that really do embody your vision and your mission and just the way that you connect and collaborate and do business, are there certain questions that you ask or certain things that you're looking for that you instantly will know that they'll be a great fit?
I really like, I go over everyone's resume, of course, but I really like to hear from them their experience with their previous bosses and team members. I think that says a lot. Something for me that's always a red flag in hiring is somebody who's openly negative about previous bosses or team mm-hmm. members. That's definitely something that I look for. But I always ask people to give me an example of something they've totally messed up and what they learned from it and how they handled it. I think that's very, very telling because you are going to mess up, and messing up or not is pretty unimportant. It's how you respond in those challenging moments that makes the big difference. So I like to really focus there in interviews.
Are you currently working remotely? Do you have an office?
We have an office in LA. I'm currently remote just because I'm home for my sister's wedding, but we have an office in California, and then we have a few remote team members, and we're actually coming together for a team retreat in September. So we like to bring the whole team together because we do have certain individuals that are remote.
Yes, because with certain companies working remotely, certain companies are requiring, going back to the office. At Socialfly, we have a New York office, but then we have a lot of team members all across the country. What are your tips for bringing remote and in-office teams together? And how often do you meet with your teams?
It's really tricky. COVID really changed it. And there were some amazing changes to come out of that, some that make it more challenging. I think it's tricky with a distributed team to really create that connected culture, but I also think it can absolutely be done. I think my team has been really excellent at connecting with each other remotely. So what we do is we have a lot of team events. We call it the Hive Report. So we have, a whole team, all hands. We do this quarterly. So, it gives people an opportunity to just hear from all of the team leaders, reset with the mission. We go through our guiding principles and we'll usually pick a few of them and have one of the team leaders, and we'll change it up every time, go through an example of how they use these guiding principles so we can really lay it out and make sure we're staying true to them. And then bringing people together a couple of times a year to just really get to know each other and celebrate. My leadership team, we come together every quarter at least. So that's definitely helpful for leadership to just remain connected and aligned and have people in different divisions who wouldn't necessarily spend time together, just really getting to know each other. I think starting at the top, having a culture where there's true friendship and an understanding of the different personalities, I really believe that trickles down. And then, we have just for fun events. We have a really cool culture committee and we'll do like team trivia and we'll do remote things like that. And I think I was really skeptical at the start because I'm like, hey, who wants to take an hour of their work time to do trivia? But we all had the best time and we all want to keep doing it. So I think making time to just kind of play together is really important. But I do believe that it's important to come together every so often.
How big is your team?
We have 43 people now.
Amazing. Wow, do you look back incredible. Now and think about how when you just started the business, it was you at farmers markets and now you're managing this big team across the country? Like, do you ever have those moments like, wow, I did this?
I totally do. I actually had a moment the other day because my team was looking for it to make a TikTok. They wanted like old school pictures of me standing at my farmers market booths. And we were looking at that. And then we were looking at our like Target floor displays. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is wild. So it is really, really cool to have those moments. I also think it's not natural for me to have those moments. I'm one of these people that's like constantly moving the goalpost, which is a pretty toxic trait. So I'm trying to push myself to take a minute and sit with those moments and like actively seek them out.
It's so important, just taking the time to celebrate your wins, like even things that are small, because they all add up. And running a business is really hard. And we always say it's not as glamorous as it might look on Instagram with the beautiful TikToks and all the things that have been happening. Totally. But yeah, it's amazing all that you've accomplished. And how many years has it been now? We're in 2016.
Yeah, I started in 2017.
So like super, super fast. But yeah. I always say like in entrepreneurista years, you know, a year feels like 10 years when you're running a business every year, right?
Totally. Totally. And it's been, we've had so many ups and downs. Like we've had great years and I've had really challenging years. And I think like, I don't know about for you guys, I'm curious. For me, it was such a challenge, just like the wake up call of like, oh my gosh, I need to delegate. I need to build a team now. Like this is not like a one or three person show anymore. And I feel like I came to that late. Does everyone feel that? So many entrepreneurs I speak to are like, oh yeah, I figured that out 6 months later than I should have.
I would agree with you. I think I realized that not too late, but later than maybe some others. And that, you know, you think for Stephanie and myself, you think we're going to just be creating social media strategies and working on social media campaigns all day. And what happens once you scale is you're really managing people, you're hiring, you're leading, you're setting KPIs, you're holding people accountable. And it's a different skill set. It requires a different skill set than when you initially start and you kind of just have to learn it as you go. But hiring and the people who are on the team are just so crucial to moving everything forward. So I'm still learning how to do that well. But I think we've gotten a lot right, especially in recent years. I'd love to talk about your marketing. You know, obviously Stephanie and I started a marketing agency, so we love talking about marketing. What tips do you have for anyone what you're doing is very unique, but anyone in a similar space or anyone in e-commerce and in retail, how do you balance the two initiatives, driving to retail versus D2C?
Yeah, so I think at this stage, I mean, we very much have an omnichannel sales approach. So I think at this stage, everything kind of has a ripple effect. Any brand marketing I do, it hits Amazon, it hits D2C, it hits retail. So just knowing that. But I think before I get into marketing channels and specific channel strategy, I think the most important thing for me was really getting clear on who I am as a brand, what the brand stands for, how to talk about it. Because how we talk about it shifts depending on the channel slightly, but we're pretty firm to who we are. And so, I think having that consistency is really important for consumers because they inevitably see it on different channels. So I think starting there and then understanding where your customers are. And we've tried so many different things at this point and we're constantly testing. I think that's part of what we get really right is that we're constantly willing to test and sometimes take a hit and sometimes learn something amazing.
What are some of the recent marketing tests that you've done and you can share that worked really well and others that maybe didn't hit the mark?
Yeah. So something we've just rolled out, this is very new, so I don't even have an opinion on how great it is or not, but we just did ads on all the charging stations, the electric vehicle charging stations at Targets. So that's just new for us. Cool and exciting. It looks gorgeous, but we'll see what the data says. But we're spending a lot of time looking, you know, any new social platform, we want to have a presence there. It's a new opportunity to tell our story, often with a different customer base. So that's really exciting for us. You know, we've been on Meta and Google forever. I think Amazon for top of funnel is really exciting right now. So, you know, looking at what you can do with video on Amazon. And I think that has a really great halo effect for all channels. And then, you know, doing a lot of customer activations. I feel like this was really big pre-COVID. And then you started to see more of the influencer activations, which are also awesome. We did a really cool Hive House with a bunch of fantastic influencers, which absolutely helped us to share our story and get out there. But I love doing customer events. I think maybe that's like my whole, like, gives me the little farmer's market vibe where I got to interact with people in a really special way and get really great feedback. But I think it's really special to build that connection with your customers.
When you were first starting, obviously we all had limited budgets. Where did you focus your marketing efforts at the time? And if you could do it all over again to anyone listening that's just starting, where would you recommend to focus?
Well, in 2017, Instagram was the platform. So I focused a ton of energy on that platform. I mean, I was like constantly on that platform, but something that was really important for us and still is really important for us and advice I would give for everyone is value add content, being really careful. And this might sound obvious, but I think it's really easy to get into the flow of describing and explaining your value prop when before you can even hit people with a value prop, you have to just hit them with value. Mm-hmm. And so really making sure that we were doing value add content. So the early days, whether it was Instagram or, you know, longer form content with a blog, I was really trying to think through what health problems are people having? What is confusing looking at health and wellness, whether it's keto versus paleo or, you know, a new pharmaceutical drug and what that means for different conditions, really trying to hit people with value add content, helping to be a source of clarity and then sharing our products once we've kind of had that initial interaction so that they know that there's more to come. And then I think TikTok today is what Instagram was in 2017. So, I mean, we're putting a lot of energy into that platform. I think it's a really fun platform. Like, I love that it's less curated. I love that you can do a lot of different things to express yourself on that platform. And people are really looking for that value add content, which is really cool.
Are you running ads on TikTok or doing everything organically right now?
Right now, we're doing everything organic. We've played a little bit with running ads, but for our brand, it's, you know, something that we really invest in is sampling. For our brand, you can really experience the benefits. So it's so worthwhile for us to invest in sampling and then leave it to influencers or customers or individuals to share their experience.
Going back to the early days again, so you're at these farmers markets, but before you end up there, you had to figure out the process of like navigating these farmers markets, like which ones to go to, what is it cost to be there?
That was one of the hardest things.
Like how do you figure that out? Actually, we just interviewed on the podcast a few weeks ago, the founder of Cookies with Tiffany, and she was talking too about starting her business at these farmers markets. And I'm someone who goes to I go to a farmers market in Palm Beach Gardens, like every single weekend. Like it's the best and love discovering these new brands and being like, oh my God, I bet some of these people are going to be like the next really big brand because it's really the place to start. But tell me how you navigated that process and advice you would share to someone who's starting their business and really wants to get out there at some of these markets.
Okay. So I use the term farmers market very loosely. Most of these big farmers markets have crazy wait lists. And if you're like, I have to be at this farmers market, it might not happen for several years. So, you know, I was doing some markets, but I was also doing pop-up shops. I would every year go to the yoga show and do a booth, like literally anywhere where they would let me have a little table. I was there. I would go to, you know, these kind of like craft stores and talk to the buyer there or the manager and ask if we can do an event for the cause. I think, again, like creating value for someone else. People were really interested when I brought forward the B cause, or I was talking about female founders or makers markets, that sort of thing, something that's like a cool activation for that location in their community. So I always tried to make it about that. An early thing I did that was really fun, there was this really cool juice bar. And now they've got quite a few locations now, but in the early days, it was like very vibey and it was a cool discovery place. And there was no chance they were going to put my product in there for sale. And so I went in and I did this whole pitch on like, hey, everything you guys use is bee pollinated. If we lose the bees, no more juice or smoothies. Let's do a campaign together. And so we did this like little takeover where I put pollinator stickers on every single juice that had bee pollinated ingredients, which was like all of them. And we put together a lot of really cute marketing materials just about the plight of the bees. And then we did sell my product in there, but we had 100% of profit going to the Canadian Bee Research Fund. And so doing stuff like that, like creating value, but still getting yourself out there, that was a lot of how I went about navigating the market space and, you know, just getting my product into people's hands. It wasn't in the early days. It was like, I mean, I'm curious about your experience, but it was in the early days, not at all about money. Like making money was like such an afterthought. It was just like, how can I get this in front of as many people as possible?
Yeah, you got to be scrappy and just pound the pavement. And that's what Courtney and I were doing. You know, we joined networking groups and met everyone and just got out there and wanted to be able to talk about social media and our services. So totally can relate to that. But at the end of the day, you do have to generate revenue for the business and show that you're selling. Were there, when you were at the farmers markets or at, you know, the pop-up shops that you were doing, were there, how did you take payments? How did you make money? Were there different tools and things that you were using?
Yeah, I was using Square. Square is awesome. For anybody who's at a farmer's market or a pop-up or, you know, any of these locations that I'm talking about, Square makes it really, really easy. So that was a major tool that I used in the early days. And yeah, of course, like you have to have enough money to keep going. But I think my goal was always exposure in the early days.
Totally. Have to get out there. What are some of the business tools that you're using right now with your team that keep your business running every day?
I mean, we are obsessed with Slack. Like Slack is what I use 24/7. I love Slack. We use Asana. I've used different tools. I've used like, you know, I was really into Notion for a while. I had a Trello moment a few years back, but Asana is the one I keep coming back to for project management. I just think it's a really great tool. My team loves it. And yeah, and then we're constantly making different spreadsheets and we'll use Google Sheets for that sort of thing. It's just, you know, one that everyone seems to like. And so we keep coming back to that.
Oh yeah, we are obsessed with the Google Suite as well. I live in, breathe and die by my Google Calendar and everything Google. So I'm totally with you on that.
Oh, something that I've recently become very obsessed with, and I'm like pushing everyone on my team to use this, is ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, it is such a tool. Like, I feel like I'm saving so much money in legal fees. I'm just like drafting documents and then sending it to my legal team. I'm like, is this okay?
How's this look? Yeah.
Yes.
That is really great advice. Any other AI tools you're using? Photoshop just came out with a great one.
Yeah, we use Photoshop. I mean, in the editing space, my creative director and marketing team, they're using everything and they're so talented. So we always love to kind of be leveraging these new tools. I think for me, ChatGPT and, you know, everything from drafting agreements on there to editing captions, there's just so much you can do. So that's just been a really fun one that I've been playing with recently. One of the guys on my marketing team is also obsessed and he's like sending me ChatGPT prompts and we're like, who's better with your prompts? So that's been really fun just getting to learn from him and use that platform.
Yeah, it is amazing what you can do with these AI tools now and just a time saver. Like if you think about how much time it would have taken to write all of these captions, like, yes, you still need someone to look over it and edit it and like spruce it up a bit. But just that initial draft, it's like, wow. And yeah, I love that advice about drafting contracts and then sending it to your attorney to look at. Definitely saves on the hourly.
Oh my gosh. So helpful. So helpful. And yeah, and by the way, we still have an unbelievable copywriter on our team and she's really leveraging these tools just to be more efficient with her own work.
That's the thing. I was just talking to a former intern of ours who is now graduating from college and she hasn't really gotten into all of the ChatGPT stuff yet. And I said, you know, start using this because when you go interview, it's not that this is going to replace you, but you can be like, you'll be so much more efficient than everyone else. Like if you need to write 10 articles, you can write 30 articles. And
that's such great advice. Yeah. I think so many people are scared of these sorts of things and it's threatening. It's new. And, you know, this conversation around AI and what jobs it will eliminate is very real, but you know, it's also here. And I think everyone would do very well to learn how to use these platforms for themselves.
Totally.
Is there a moment looking back at your entrepreneurial career so far that is the craziest thing Or, you know, Stephanie and I always say, like, when we're telling stories of something that happened, we're like, you can't even make this up. So if you have a moment like that, I'd love to hear it.
Oh my gosh, I've had so many. I think, well, when I was setting up our apiaries, I mean, we have an international sourcing model. I'm actually going to Spain next month to visit one of our apiaries. But because we do pesticide-free, we're really limited geographically. So, you know, just if you think about it, you can't, so blueberries, certified organic land, you put the blueberries there, they stay put. Just because a hive is on certified organic land, it doesn't mean the bees won't fly next door. And the bees will forage for a 5-mile radius. So I need like a lot of clean land. It's really hard to find that in the United States, just with pesticide regulation, with the way sides of roads are sprayed. It's really, really tricky. And so a lot of my apiaries are abroad. We do a ton of work in Brazil. We do a ton of work in Europe, a ton of work in Canada. In the early days, like setting up these apiaries, I met some really interesting characters. I mean, Dimitri, who's one of our lead beekeepers who I adore, he's like getting me to do vodka shots instead of like a handshake. Like he's just like such a character. And, you know, you just, beekeepers are a really interesting group. It's a job that is less social. You're spending a lot of time with the bees. And I was meeting so many different people. And I think also having to find the individuals who are willing to do pesticide-free beekeeping and take, you know, the 10 extra steps to do it sustainably because they really care. It's a really unique individual. So I've spent time going all over the world to set up our unbelievably complicated sourcing model. And in doing that, I've just met some amazing people along the way. So I've had a ton of experiences there. And then I think fundraising is always a journey. Fundraising is always kind of wild, who you end up meeting, and just, you know, the pace is really fun.
How much have you raised to date since starting your business?
We have raised just over 25 million.
Tell us your top 3 tips for founders that are currently raising capital right now in this market. What advice would you share?
It is a hard environment right now. I just closed a round. Do not give up. So for me, when I did my first fundraise, I started the company bootstrapping. I had proof of concept. I think I got up to around 600K in sales. And it was from that point that I went to raise money because I had a very clear, you know, I had a very clear value prop. I was very clear on what I needed in terms of use of funds because I was already in market. I was very clear about the steps I needed to take to scale. Of course, all these things I thought I was clear on changed a million times, but I had something that I thought I was clear on. And I think that's really, really important. So, you know, even if you're raising pre-revenue, really playing it out and playing out the worst case scenario and the best case scenario, and then the problems that come if it's the best case scenario, how you scale from there. Just really encourage people to do that. I think most entrepreneurs are really thoughtful and thorough and will maybe spend a lot of time in one of those scenarios. And so what I do when I'm fundraising now is I have a worst, middle, best scenario, and I model those 3 out and I bring those with me. And that way I can get really clear. We can get into really granular conversations. And I think it gives people a lot more ease about, you know, understanding how I would react in a challenging or really positive situation.
Final question for you, Carly. What does being an entrepreneurista mean to you?
It means resilience. Courtney, you said this a little bit earlier, but how the job changes as an entrepreneur. Whatever you think you're good at, too bad you're not doing that in 6 months. So I have had to really cultivate resilience because my job is just constantly changing. And that's a beautiful thing. It really pushes you. It creates a really expansive mindset. But I think going in knowing that, like, whether I'm bad or good at this, it may or may not be something I'm going to be doing going forward. So I just have to really understand it now and then be ready for the next thing.
Well, I am so excited to try all of your products and continue to connect and follow and see all of the great things you're going to continue to accomplish. Carly, where can everyone find you and follow you? And for those that are interested in trying Beekeepers Naturals, where should they head to do so?
Okay, well, we are on every social platform, Beekeepers_Naturals, Instagram, TikTok. I'm on TikTok at Carly the Beekeeper. You can find our products at Target, at Whole Foods, at CVS, Walgreens, Amazon, of course, and our website, beekeepersnaturals.com.
Carly, thank you again for being here. I'm Stephanie.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is the best business meeting we've ever had.
Hey, thanks for listening and leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'd love to stay in touch with each of you. You can listen to all of our latest episodes at entrepreneurista.com and connect with us on Instagram at entrepreneuristas. We'd also love to invite you to join the Entrepreneurista League, our private membership community for trailblazing women. You can head over to entrepreneurista.com/the-league. We'll see you there. Wishing you a productive week ahead.